dignity,
security,
freedom,
respect,
justice,
equality,
equality,
remedy, protection,
fairness,
fair time,
citizens,
right,
work,
peace,
losers,
men.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression.
Expression.
Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Focus.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solid.
I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. I'm Jim Hutchings, and with me today is my co-host Gord Barnes, and our special guest, Dr. James Dachuk, a professor in the Faculty of Kinesiology and Health Sciences at the University of Regina, and more to the point, award-winning author of Clearing the Plains, Disease, Politics of Starvation, and the Loss of Aboriginal Life. With the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission still fresh in our minds, we thought it would be useful to refer to Jim's book to try to gain a better understanding of what has happened to Canada's Aboriginal peoples since Confederation, and how much of that was deliberate government policy? And we have less than an hour. Welcome, everyone.
Well, thanks, guys. Great to be here.
Good to have you. Good to have you. And, a lot to talk about. I was thinking it would probably be worth beginning the program by just taking a moment and acknowledging, as we have previously, that we are here on Treaty 4 territory, and that's a topic that we should come back to a little later in the conversation, perhaps, in terms of the making of Treaty 4 itself. But welcome, James. It's fabulous to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah.
Often what I've done in conversations I'm talking to First Nations people is, I'll acknowledge Treaty 4 territory, and on behalf of my people, the settlers, I wish my ancestors had treated your ancestors a fair amount better, actually.
I have to admit I haven't read your book. I've read some reviews and some statements from it, and we had the pleasure of having your presentation at the Unitarian Center a little while ago, and it's stunning the way the government treated Aboriginal peoples from the time of Confederation. It's just unimaginable. really.
For sure. And it's really interesting to talk about the book in the context of human rights, like specifically human rights, because most of us, you know, you guys are in, you know, sort of involved in the struggle, but most Canadians wouldn't think of the term human rights in the context of their own countries, right? We judge Latin America, we're just talking about Latin America or other countries, but I mean, we've got human rights issues galore that have lasted more than a century that we've yet to deal with. Mm-hmm. And in the context of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you know, that's a human rights document. I mean, this has the potential to have the impact of, you know, the same kind of impact as the civil rights movement in the United States. So I think we're at a moment.
You know, I've been trying to think over the last day or two about how to have this conversation about your book, and it's such an impressive amount of work that you must have. My understanding from reading it, you actually put 20 years work into this, and that's a lot of time and thought, I'm sure.
Sadly, that's because I think slow.
But it is impressive. But one of the pieces that I thought would be worth beginning the conversation about is if you could talk about, you know, because this book does talk, a significant theme of the book is obviously the health of Indigenous peoples. And at the very beginning of your book, you talk about the state of health of people or First Nations people prior to contact, before people mm-hmm. settled in North America from other countries. And I wonder if you could, that piece is really a significant part of the book because it sets a stage for, you know, what happened later. So I wonder if would that be a good place?
Start at the beginning. Yeah, and actually, I thought that first chapter. So this is a chapter. I can't remember what it's actually called in the book, but it's basically the prehistoric before the arrival of Europeans.
Right.
And I actually think that is the most heretical chapter in the book. It's probably the most original research and the original conclusions. And what I found was that prior to Europeans, Eastern North America, including the prairies, wasn't, you know, sort of a, it wasn't a golden age. And indigenous societies' responses to climate change, because there was a huge, basically, climate cataclysm in the mid-13th centuries, around 1250 AD, that actually shook some foundations to their core. The metropolis of Eastern North America, Cahokia, at the confluence of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers, a city that was so big, its urban population wasn't surpassed until Philadelphia overtook it in 1800. Like, that's how big it was. And it was basically, some archaeologists have argued that was the capital of a state, like that level of social organization, mm-hmm. sophistication. That city was abandoned. Like, this, you know, the institutions broke down, and that city was abandoned 100 years before Columbus ever tripped over the Bahamas. So, like I said, you know, that's one sort of heretical thing, is that things weren't perfect, and they weren't continuing in a perfect way. But another sort of finding from that chapter was that the Great Plains, Northern Great Plains, acted as a sanctuary to all of those sort of environmental refugees at the time. And from the archaeological record, I have a BA in archaeology, and I used to dig too fast, so I ended up having to move into history. But one of the things I found was that after that significant period of climate change was that the archaeological record gets a whole lot more complex. It was very, very stable on the prairies. You know, people were happy hunting bison. But a slew of new groups move west from the woodlands, from sort of, you know, say, Manitoba, Minnesota, all the way down to Texas. They move to the prairies and take on pedestrian, like bison hunting on foot. And their societies actually were quite large, 1,000, 2,000 people per community. And basically managed the environment. They knew where the bison were, and by the 19th century, people who've been hunting bison were, according to physical anthropology studies, were the tallest people in the world because of the high protein, low fat diet afforded by bison. Basically, you had steak every day, the original Atkins diet.
So, you know, and just with that early introduction to the book and the very first portion, I wanted to mention that what I got out of that part and later was that whole piece around the significance of when people refer to First Nations peoples as compared to people. And I you know, that was something that people talked about a number of years ago. Putting the S on the end of peoples, people, is really important. And just the way you talk just now and in your book, that is a constant theme, because you pick that up. You tell the story of how various peoples lived and the state of their health, for that matter.
For sure. And, I mean, some of those societies succeeded. For example, as Cahokia, as I said, the metropolis of North America, failed, the people to the north, the Iroquoian-speaking people, came together after a few generations of violence and came together under the League of the Haudenosaunee. And so in my book, I referred to that as really an adaptation to climate. So in the 500 years or so, nobody's exactly sure when it happened, no member of the League of the Iroquois, of the Haudenosaunee, has killed another one. That's a pretty good adaptation. And, some people have argued that the terms of the League of the Haudenosaunee were kind of a model for the Americans as they set up their country.
And then, you begin to explore in your book as well the impact of people having to move because the consequence of the fur trade decline in Eastern Canada and what that meant relative to the economy in Western Canada, what's referred to now as Western Canada, and the health of people as they came into sometimes conflict with each other, and also the significance of disease. So maybe there's a lot there in terms of themes, but can you share some of your...
Well, I guess the context I put this in was the expansion of what some scholars have called the modern world system. And really what it is the capitalist economy. And as fur traders based in New France, there was a very small enclave around Quebec City, Montreal, and a little bit further west. As their contact and trade increased with the indigenous nations to the west, specifically the Huron-Wendat and other people, the Ottawa, for example, in northern Ontario, as the trade relationship became more and more sophisticated and more regular, there's sort of an organic component, was that disease came with it. So that's almost an inevitable process. And in our world of globalization over the last 20 or 30 years, we're seeing the same thing, right? Like we saw those Ebola breakouts and people are very concerned about those things. So I think that's kind of like the unseen organic component of what we have thought in the past of as strictly economic relationships, right? The fur trade. And as game is depleted, as the indigenous producers are depleted as well by mortality from epidemic disease, the system has to grow, I don't know about exponentially, but it has to continue to grow and grow and grow to probably by the end of the 18th century, you've got Europeans, bumping into the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm. And, the issue of disease is a theme throughout as well. One of the things that you talked about later in the book, and I made a reference to where it is, but it is the whole concept of virgin soil. And I think many people won't even be familiar with that who haven't read the book. And I wonder if you can just sort of share some information about that, because I think that alone is something that people would want to find out about.
Sure. And I mean, that's the key concept, and probably a key concept for understanding global relation, like around the globe, relationship between, Northern Europeans and indigenous people everywhere, potentially. And so the idea of a virgin soil epidemic is the outbreak of a disease in a community that has either never experienced the disease or hasn't experienced the disease since the life of the eldest person in that community. So smallpox, up until actually a generation ago, we probably all have our smallpox scars, from our immunizations. Smallpox has been the deadliest disease in human history. And I don't know the science of it, but in doing my research, it has something to do with our relationship with cattle over the last 10,000 years. And so those of us who are from Eurasia, have experienced smallpox in the past, and by the time of the Colombian contact, if you want to think about it that way, smallpox was an endemic disease. And actually, one of my anthropology teachers back at McMaster 30 years ago or more told us that smallpox in England during the 19th century was so prevalent that if you had a wanted poster, say for a highwayman, you know, we can all sort of imagine that, if the wanted poster, the person they wanted on the wanted poster did not have pox, they actually mentioned that because not having pox was made you stand out in a crowd. So, smallpox was part of everyone's life in the old world, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess ecologically, that didn't happen at all in America, because basically the ecosystem of America and Eurasia, Africa were almost completely different. There were a few birds that flew over, you know, Bering Strait and that kind of thing, but we had very, very different environments. So when the Europeans came over, the first Europeans, you know, these would be, early 15th, 16th century Spaniards, they had no idea of the germ theory, but they had the germs with them. And so when those diseases broke out, for example, Cortez, I think, had a couple hundred soldiers. They had horses that the people had never seen before. And, you know, I'm sure that Cortez and his conquistadors were badasses, but they managed to overthrow potentially the second or third biggest city in the world with that small a number. And it really wasn't, you know, their physical prowess, their ability to fight. It was a smallpox epidemic that had undermined the ability of the Aztec people to really put on a strong defense and probably, you know, to nip that in the bud. So in a virgin soil epidemic, and for example with smallpox, you either live or die in the span of 3 weeks. So in the span of 3 weeks, and what happens is in a virgin soil epidemic, potentially you have 80% mortality in your community. So in the span of 3 weeks, you lose 8 out of 10 of your elders, 8 out of 10. That's especially significant because in indigenous societies, knowledge and wisdom, philosophy, ethics, you name it, are passed orally from generation to generation. So if you're the elders are the library of your community. If you lose 8 out of 10 elders in the span of 3 weeks, you've just impoverished your knowledge. But you also lose 8 out of 10 of your hunters, 80% of your children. Those societies are never really the same again. And often what we see here, the virgin soil epidemic in this part of the world was probably in the 1780s. And many of the Cree communities that were identified by the first traders as freestanding individual communities with identities, there was so much mortality that a lot of those people came together, the survivors, you know, sort of reestablished family relationships. And that's where you see the identity known as the Plains Cree, you know, sort of in modern times. It's you know, the survivors of that terrible epidemic.
And, you mentioned earlier about people being pedestrian buffalo hunters, right? And sort of what that means is there weren't horses, I guess, at that time.
Right? Yeah, we didn't get horses in this part of the country probably until the 1750s. So if you think about the millennia of occupation of indigenous people, they were doing fine without horses. In fact, some have argued that horses enabled individuals to work as family units rather than collectively as communities. And what that did was that created disparities in wealth. Like, people with the best horses ended up acquiring, you know, the most goods. And this is also at the same time as the modern world system is sort of rolling its way onto the prairies. So you can see how, you know, probably a lot of the institutions that had functioned for years were undermined by, you know, by something that we think of as, you know, sort of a benevolent force like horses. Man, you can travel so much faster.
And that, you know, I must say that when I thought about that personally, that was something that was a learning experience for me, because the idea that people could hunt buffalo without horses, you know, challenged that whole idea, because so much of the artwork, mm-hmm. and the history that we might have learned showed First Nations people riding a horse and hunting mm-hmm. buffalo.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, so grateful that that was a part of your book as well.
And in one sense, you know, I've spoken about this to my students. You know, the image of an equestrian indigenous warrior is really potentially only a, you know, maybe 100 years, a mm-hmm. century, out of millennia. And there's an archaeologist from University of Calgary, Dale Waldie, who's sort of the expert. I sort of based my views on his work. And what he talked about is that era of pedestrian hunting, which lasted, you know, for thousands of years, by people collaborating and I guess non-disturbing the animals as they took whatever they needed. You know, they didn't stampede them, for example. Those communities were able to function at very high levels in very sophisticated societies, you know, and knowing where the animals were most of the time. So my joke with my students is, how many do we need for the barbecue tonight? Let's go up to and let's just go get that many. And so, yeah, the idea of, a chase hunt with, a stampede was probably at the tail end of that period. And, European observers have shown that actually the bison became very unreliable at that time, because as soon as they'd see somebody on a horse, they'd probably take off.
So the buffalo figured it out.
The buffalo figured it out.
I remember visiting Wanuskewin and apparently you'd have one tribe member at one point or other that would be the decoy and sort of lived apart and, I guess, dressed in buffalo skins and all the rest of it, and smelled like a buffalo, didn't smell like a guy, and he'd kind of lead them to the edge of a cliff.
Yeah, or, you just gently move them along. And there, I think there might be Paul Kane paintings. You can see people with wolf coverings, and they would basically mimic the actions of a wolf. And, not necessarily stampede them toward, the buffalo pound or the jump. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. So, and that was a very effective strategy. And all those sort of environmental refugees I spoke of a little bit earlier, they took up that same strategy. And, the communities were thriving at the time that Europeans ended up showing up.
So the whole discussion around the issue of disease and people's changing economies was such a central theme in your book. And, the conversation's probably going to jump around a little bit here, but by the time of the point where people were treaty making, they were in many, many situations literally hungry, and hunger played a significant part of treaty making, as you mentioned in your book, even in terms of the completion of Treaty 4.
Treaty 4, rations were given out at Treaty 4, and I can't remember what the number was, 3,000 or 4,000 people gathered at Treaty 4, because they were on the eastern edge of the herds, which were receding at that time, and there are a bunch of reasons for that. Actually, there's a great book called Pemmican Empire by my friend George Kolpitz from the University of Calgary that talked about just how important the pemmican trade was, because if you think about it, at this time in the 1870s, but through most of the 19th century, Red River, which became the city of Winnipeg, was a city of 10,000 people that was basically living on a hunting and gathering sort of economy. That's the basis of the Métis economy, was hunting. So by the time of Treaty 4, There were game shortages in the Eastern Plains, and I guess at the time through the 1870s, First Nations people had been it wasn't like they weren't cognizant of agriculture. Many of them had gardens, had sort of places where they lived and kept gardens and stuff like that. So you see during the treaty negotiations of Treaty 4 and Treaty 6 that there that assistance in the conversion to agriculture as a primary way of life, I guess, is included in the terms of the treaty. And my friend Sarah Carter's written a book about how that all went awry in Lost Harvest, which is a classic book. I think it's been 25 years since that one was published.
And the context of that, of course, was that the government of the day and the prime minister of the day was using food as a way to reduce people's capacity, was literally starving people into a situation where they couldn't otherwise.
And so the way I portrayed that in the book was up at the negotiations for Fort Carleton. So people in Carleton were actually in very good shape in 1876 during those negotiations. And I've often spoke about the negotiations at Carleton were in September, I think, of 1876. Just a couple months after Custer and the 7th Cavalry lost their lives at the Battle of Little Bighorn. It's a few hundred kilometers away. But everyone at Fort Carleton knew what had happened. First Nations and the Mounties and representatives of Queen Victoria. Nobody wanted violence, but I think everyone showed up, if not prepared for violence. For example, the Mounties were ordered in their Red Surge, and they were there, as many Mounties as they could scare up. There were only a few hundred across the prairies. They were ordered to gather there as a show of force, to represent the power of the Queen. I'm sure the Plains Cree were doing the same thing. So those negotiations at Fort Carleton, I think they took place over 3 or 4 days. Those were probably the most earnest, most business-like negotiations of all the numbered treaties, because there was no pressing need for that treaty. So rather than people being forced into treaty, they accepted the treaty, but they accepted the treaty on a number of legally binding promises. And I guess that's another thing to bring out is treaties aren't just sort of artifacts that belong in archives. Treaties are the legal foundation for the society that came later, like our sort of mainstream Saskatchewan society. In British legal tradition, without what's been known as the surrender of land, I'm making quotation marks with my fingers, without the surrender of land, it would have been illegal for white settlers to come west. So in the negotiations at Treaty 6, I believe it was Chief Beardy who said that he was very concerned about the future of the bison. And if the bison fail, what's our option? And so, part of the terms of Treaty 6 was extra assistance in the conversion of agriculture. But Chief Beardy also negotiated a promise, basically, of humanitarian relief in the time of famine, the food and pestilence, or the famine and pestilence clause. And so the government agreed, and these are in the terms of Treaty 6. You can check it out on the internet. But basically, the government agreed that the Queen or the representative of the Queen would alleviate the suffering of, using the old term, Indian people in a time of crisis. Well, what nobody realized was that 18 months later, there was a crisis. The bison disappeared, and it was almost at the same time. It's funny how some things converge. Just a few months after the outbreak of the famine, the disappearance of the bison, MacDonald, Prime Minister Johnny MacDonald, was reelected on the platform of the national policy. And, of course, we all know that the national policy was based, the key plank in that was the construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway. So MacDonald has been reelected. He's got one major project he wants to undertake. And to his credit, that is probably the ultimate mega project in Canadian history. It is the spine of Canada, right? But something we don't think about, and I never really thought about this until maybe after, writing Clearing the Plains, was that for 10 years after MacDonald's re-election, he was the minister in charge of Indian Affairs. So, he had a couple big files he was in charge of, right? He's building this railway, he's trying to hold the country together. But in his own mind, he thought that Indigenous issues, okay, whatever generic term that is, were so important, he didn't entrust that to anyone else. And under his watch, we have the withholding of food, forcing of people onto reserves, the confinement of people on reserves after 1885 with the pass system, which was in place at least until the 1940s, maybe even into the early 50s, and the residential school system. So under MacDonald oversaw all of those. Actually, we're talking on Human Rights Radio. All of those human rights issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been his mixed legacy. We're just finishing up the bicentennial of his birth. And, man, there's been a lot of talk about, how do we remember MacDonald?
Yeah. I think we're going to pause at that point. We're at the bottom of the hour. And we're talking to Jim Daszak. And primarily about his book and a wide, wide topic that you've covered there. And it is powerful stuff, talking about where the Aboriginal population is now, how they got there, and where they go from here. But anyway, we'll come back and talk some more about that after this break. And we've got some music coming up, and I'll let Jim talk about it when it's over. Okay, we'll play it out of the break, and we'll be right back.
Fort Capel came a dapple gray. His children coughed blood in the autumn rains. Broke the treaty when the buffalo failed. Fenced the land for the CP rail. As for horses, at the Great Divide, forget what they taught about the medicine line. It's just for horses at the Great Divide. Saw a black horse at Cut Knife Creek, but the great pound maker was a man of peace. Spared the soldiers to his word, so they hung the braves had for battle fur. There's four horses at the Great Divide. Get what they taught about the medicine line. Like a storm,
like a storm
on a distant sky. There's
four horses
at the Great. The third horse danced for the great white chief. Hunger's a lesson that's so easy to teach. Kill a warrior, you need a gun in hand. To kill a people, you need a bureaucrat man. They taught about the medicine line.
Like a storm
on a distant sky. There's four horses at the Great Divide. In school, bogus they say, you can be so cruel. Spirit lives on across the great North Plains as the people find their voice again.
There's four horses
at the Great Divide.
And there it is, four horses. And so now it's your turn to tell us all about it, Jim. We're talking to Jim Daszak here, and that was Charlie Angus singing that song.
Yeah, so that's one of many crazy experiences that I've happened that have happened to me since the publication of Clearing the Plains. The folks at U of R Press were trying to get the word out because they felt this was an important, important issue. That's why I took it on. And they had a number of books sent to MPs that were on a list for the Heritage Committee, and they wanted this to be, part of the discussion at the Heritage Committee. Well, because the committee system under the Harper government was so moribund, they hadn't actually updated the Heritage Committee, and Charlie Angus wasn't on the Heritage Committee. They just hadn't updated the website. But they sent a book to Charlie Angus, and within a couple months, I got an email, and I guess just as a backstory, I'm from Timmins, Ontario, as is Charlie Angus. We didn't know each other, and we're not that far apart in age, but I've been following Charlie Angus's career as an activist for probably 20 years. Like, he's kind of a hero of mine. He's done so much. And so he emailed me, and he's like, Jim Dostrak, I hear you're from Timmins. Really liked your book, and I wrote a song about it. I hope you like it. So I guess that's his medium. He's a musician. Yep. And so we've had conversations since then, and he said, actually, that was quite a shocker. And I guess the reference to the medicine line was he'd always thought that the medicine line was, a symbol of, sort of Victorian Canadian justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess clearing the plains changed his attitude. And, many Canadian people who were resident in what became Canada actually went to the States to find sanctuary. And we don't often think, we've got this sort of impression that the United States was monolithically violent. It wasn't. But people went south to seek sanctuary. That's how bad it was here. And so Charlie ended up writing a song. And I guess just with Bruce Walsh, the director of U of R Press, being such a go-getter, he mm-hmm. ended up sort of working out the deal to make a music video, which is on YouTube. And I don't know how many hits there are, over 10,000 hits, I think.
Thousands, yeah.
So, and I know, Clearing the Plains is my PhD thesis, so it's not the, I did my best to make it, accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But in 5 minutes and 30 seconds or whatever the song is, you get the point.
Great song and easy to find. I found it no problem on YouTube. Just look for Charlie Angus and Four Horses. And great song. We'll have to, I want to hear some more of Charlie's songs, that's for sure. Yeah.
So in that discussion, you also mentioned in the University of Regina Press, which I've been very impressed with in the last several years, with what they've accomplished, and including your book, but others. But one of the things relative to your book is they've put together a really impressive, and maybe this was you, James, who did it, a study guide. And I must say that if people who are listening want to, access this book in a more interesting way and more thoughtful way than even this today's conversation, you can go to the study guide at the University of Regina Press and really find some good, worthwhile questions to think about as you're reading it.
this is, I guess, the study guide and the resource package. It was the idea of my good friend Rob Nestor, who teaches at University of Regina. He was using Clearing the Plains. I come in as a guest lecturer, and he said, there's so much interest. Why don't we write up the study guide? So it's like, okay, but how do you do that? But what we did was we recruited my friend Kim Sadowski, who's an Indigenous studies teacher at TOM. She just won the Governor General's Award for Excellence in Teaching. And she wrote up high school level discussion questions as part of the study guide. And so it's tough for me. You see in the forest for the trees, I guess. But Kim did a great job. But one of the things I started to think about was basically... there's an unwritten rule among us grad students or historians was that 95% of the notes we take, of the data we collect, never makes it into the final product. In fact, Clearing the Plains, the last editorial, activity with Clearing the Plains was hacking down 20% of the volume. But again, that's a dissertation, right? You want to cover your rear end as many ways as you can. So I had literally hundreds of files of research notes, of documents that were sitting in a box. So with this opportunity, what I did was I probably spent, and Nikita Longman from University of Regina Press gave me a lot of support on this, is I think we uploaded 412 separate files that I took in preparation for Clearing the Plains. So for example, I spent a year and a half working as a researcher at the University of Manitoba Medical School doing nothing but reading Hudson's Bay Company post journals. Now, that's probably a job only a historian could love, but I had a great time. But I basically transcribed those post journals, and it was, I think, up on the website is just about every Hudson's Bay post journal prior to 1800. Cumberland House was the first set up in 1874. So there are probably, 80 or 90, maybe even 100 individual post journals. So if you're interested in what happened at Cumberland House through the end of the 18th century. Check it out, because the Hudson's Bay Company kept their posts. They ran their posts almost as ships. So they were daily logs, representation of weather conditions. And every time an indigenous producer came in, they described the producer. Often they named the producer, said where they came from, if their families came, what kind of shape they were in, how, you know, what game, you know, what the situation for game was. So they're a treasure trove of information. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't sure what was important at the time, so I took a lot of notes. So there are sources from the Hudson's Bay Company archives. There are sources from the Northwest Mounted Police, because they were, you know, a very important presence. Government records, medical reports, that kind of thing. And rather than those sitting, you know, decaying in my office, I totally encourage anyone to go and use them. You know, I guess that's in the spirit of open access these days. You know, if someone else can use those documents, I'm more than happy to have gotten them up there. Thanks for bringing it up. There's a sales pitch.
With reference to 1874, you said Cumberland House was the
1774.
First, 1774. Yep. Oh, okay. That makes more sense. But up until that time, I suppose, Hudson Bay Company had been basically at York Factory and let the furs come to them.
Yeah, and I guess documentary record-wise, if that's a term, there were a few sort of diaries and stuff from what they called Montreal traders, traders who were based in Montreal. There were actually, my daughters go to the French school, and I teach Indigenous studies in French at the university, and the first European language out here was at European language was actually French. The, mm-hmm. the French had a presence. Fort Alacorn was quite close to Prince Albert, and La Vérendrye was here probably a generation or more than the first English-speaking explorer traders. And so there are a few records that I used, but really where the regular day-to-day accounts come in is the Hudson's Bay Company. But like I said, there's a 30-40 year record of many, many areas across Western and Northern Canada.
What a resource. It's just amazing.
Oh yeah, it's great. And actually I'm working on a different topic right now. I'm working on the outbreak of tuberculosis in the Arctic. So I'm actually looking at Hudson's Bay Company post records from the 20th century, and thankfully they're typewritten rather than written with a you know, with a goose quill pen.
Right.
But they're a day-to-day account of environmental conditions on Baffin Island through the 1920s.
Right.
Fascinating.
So what year was it that Canada got Rupert's Land? Was that 1870?
1869-70, mm-hmm. I guess, was the Rupert's Land purchase. Yeah. And so that's all of the territory that drained into Hudson's Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And I should add another thing to that statement, is that the Rupert's Land purchase was for the Royal Charter of Rupert's Land.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they bought the land. I think they bought the rights to the land. That's why we had the treaty process, was to get the land surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess as a vestige of the Royal Proclamation from 100 years earlier was the final formal peace treaty of the Seven Years' War. It was basically England taking possession of the territory that became, you know, sort of became Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the statements in the Royal Proclamation was that all of the land that isn't already occupied and isn't already colonized by Europeans shall be, I'm just trying to think of what the wording is, basically shall be preserved for, again, using the 250-year-old term, for the Indians and for the use of the Indians. So in British jurisprudence, if you haven't had a treaty, it belongs to the First Nation that occupies it. Which is, you know, a different way of thinking about the treaties, but it's like, that's how we got here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I guess that's really been important in BC and other places where there were no treaties.
Yeah, for sure. And like we're you know, sort of seeing that process flesh out. But if you think about it, and I was talking about Treaty 6 earlier on, I believe that the negotiations of Treaty 6, Alexander Morris was the representative of the Queen. He couldn't pull the wool over the eyes of the Plains Cree negotiators. Like they had a true negotiation, from my perspective anyways. And but so the negotiation to me was okay.
Mm-hmm.
It was the implementation of treaties,
right.
Because, you know, we've got a 140-year tradition of Treaty 6.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Treaty 6 was broken. You know, those terms, as I mentioned, the famine and pestilence clause, were broken 18 months after the completion of the treaty.
Right.
And probably have continued to be broken ever since.
Yep. under McDonald's leadership.
Under McDonald, but I mean that system continued.
Yeah, right.
You know, the last residential school only closed in, I think, 1995.
You know, there's another discussion I'm hoping we can get you to share. And in Chapter 8 of your book, it talks about the administration of relief efforts and the role of Dewdney in particular. And I just think here in Regina, many people will know the name Dewdney Avenue, but not know his role in terms of that period of our history. And I think it's worth sharing that if you're
sure
okay to go through that discussion a bit.
Yeah, so I believe, in my research, yeah, Edgar Dewdney was McDonald's point man, if you will, out here in the West. I think McDonald may have come west on a train once. I could even be wrong about that. He wasn't the person dealing with things in the field. So Edgar Dewdney was his most trusted official out here. Something I guess I didn't know until doing the research is that this is before the railway actually shows up. And doing my research at Saskatchewan Archives Board, I was reading the Saskatchewan Herald newspaper. Actually, that's another thing that's up on that study guide, is a weekly account from Battleford from 1878 up until the 1890s. So I'm reading the paper, and as they're deciding on where the railway is going to be, I'm reading this, you know, in Regina, and they said, oh, they picked a new territorial capital. Battleford was briefly the territorial capital, and it was going to be Leopold. I'm like, where the heck is Leopold? And they said, it's halfway between McLean and Moose Jaw. It's like, oh, okay. So, anyhow, Edgar Dewdney came just about that time. So, like, you know, Regina isn't the thriving metropolis that it is now. And the way that Dewdney came was by steamboat to Fort Benton, Montana. Fort Benton, Montana was actually historically a very important community. It was the last place up the Missouri River that steamboats could go. They probably set a rapids there that mm-hmm. you couldn't cross with the steamboat. So it became a very important transshipment point for the West, for the ranching industry, but also, I guess, for the purposes of the book, for the relief industry. And at the time, you know, as the Bison disappeared and the Northwest Mounted Police were providing humanitarian assistance, even in $1,880, the government of Canada was probably spending $1 million or more a year on food relief. And it was coming through basically one company, the I.G. Baker Company, which had formerly been a whiskey trading operation, but they realized there was actually bigger money in government contracts. Mm-hmm. So at that time, in 1880, prior to the railway showing up, there were very few white settlers, probably a couple hundred white settlers in Battleford, but there was a minimal settler presence, if you will. Like, there were very, very few farmers, and where the economy was supporting the Northwest Mounted Police and the Indian Department in those days. And I.G. Baker was essentially the monopoly contractor. The Hudson's Bay Company simply could not compete with them because they're American capitalists. They knew how to get the job done, and actually, in doing so, getting the job done, they had Edgar Dewdney on the payroll. So he was probably collecting back pocket kickbacks, if you will. And Edgar Dewdney, through those years of famine and crisis and several reports of basically, for lack of a better term, rotten food being provided to people who were suffering and, like, you know, living through an outbreak of tuberculosis, basically providing rotten, sometimes poisonous food to the indigenous population while Dewdney was profiting. And again, in those days, there were no strict criteria for government officials not to profit from their positions. So Dewdney knew how far to push it and, you know, sort of survived politically. And it's interesting that Dewdney was probably the agent of subjugation out here, but he knew enough. You know, he might have been shifty, but he was smart. He knew not to push too much. And there was a period, actually, after this is a very sad story, over 100 people died from eating basically rancid bacon near Sinaloa. I think it was in the fall of 1883. And as that scandal was sort of breaking out, Dewdney took a sabbatical and went back to British Columbia for a little while, like probably to let the dust settle. And over that winter, basically the Indian Department accountant Lawrence Manganette, who was an Ottawa accountant, had no experience in the West, tried to run Indian Affairs, you know, in this very high pressure job, and he almost had borderline outbreaks of violence throughout reserves on the West because he was so strict. And when Dewdney came back, he actually managed to, if not placate people, to avoid violence. So kind of a mixed, he's an interesting character, but very mixed legacy on that part. Mm. So there's, I've even spoken to people, you know, who've talked about, should we be memorializing Edgar Dewdney, especially as, you know, that's the throughway through North Central where, you know, a lot of the people who live there have lived with the the baggage mm-hmm. of MacDonald and Dewdney's policies.
Yeah, I think I was telling you earlier they're having similar discussions about Cornwallis in Halifax.
Yeah, and Cornwallis had a terrible legacy. Like he wrote genocidal tombs. Like we must go and kill the indigenous people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and
offered bounties.
Yeah, for sure.
So. Quite a legacy we have. I don't know.
I'm not sure, Jim, how much time we've got, but I just...
Well, we've got a little less than 5 minutes, okay. So we should wrap things up here, right?
I guess one of the things is in your concluding part of the book, James, you talk about how the whole book does look at the ecological, economic, and political forces that then shaped the medical history of First Nations people in Western Canada in particular. And, you know, when we think about that in the context of then things like treaty making and later residential school experiences and things like that, I read your Globe Mail piece, by the way, and that was so powerful that the timing was so significant. But what is your hope in terms of when people are reading your book and thinking about the research that you've done?
It's been very interesting. As a professor, we have the best job going, you know. We can sort of follow our noses. But in the last couple of years, I've given we have to account, you know, like for our activities. So at the end of 2015, I counted 50 public talks and interviews.
Wow.
Okay, so outside of my teaching job. And one of the things I've really sort of encountered is when I'm speaking to First Nations people, often, you know, I'll see heads nodding. And what it is, yeah, we know. Mm-hmm. Like those are our family stories.
Yeah.
Where I've been the most surprised, and for lack of a better term, it's predominantly white audiences, because most of us have never heard these stories and have, like, it's coming out of the blue. So it's a shock, and here's one example. I gave a talk at in Edmonton, and there was a mixed crowd of First Nations people and oil company executives. Long story, okay? And there was a lawyer I'd spoken to. I just chatted, you know, like as I'm getting my USB stick into the computer, you know, I said hi to him, and he was sitting quite close to me. And so in this mixed crowd, at the end of my talk, he really looked upset. And enough that it was like, man, are you okay? he was kind of shaken. And he said, well, actually, I feel like I've been kicked in the guts. And I was like, what's going on? He said, well, okay, so this guy's a lawyer in Edmonton, and he's, you know, working out deals in the oil patch or whatever. But he grew up in Kindersley. And so when he grew up, probably on a century farm in Kindersley, a beautiful country, mm-hmm. as a kid, it was like an archaeological, you know, like for a kid, he was finding arrowheads and he would find teepee rings and all kinds of stuff. And I showed the map of basically the ethnic cleansing of Western Saskatchewan, where 5,000 to 7,000 people were seeking refuge in the Cypress Hills and where they were forced to go to that sort of congregation of reserves around Battleford a few hundred kilometers north. Well, Kindersley's kind of on that route. And what he hadn't realized until he, you know, I kind of put the two PowerPoint slides together was the people who left those artifacts were the same people, essentially, that were on reserves in Battleford. And he hadn't put those two things together, and it was a real revelation to him. And I think that's actually kind of, you know, and Clearing the Plains is not the most original book. Like, this is a scholarly, what we would call a scholarly synthesis. I put other people's work together, you know, kind of built a wall out of those individual bricks. But I think to a lot of people, it's a new and you know, pretty, I don't know, scary story, compelling story. But in knowing that, and knowing that those terrible events that happened, once you know that, you know, as my friend Mark Spooner says, you can't unknow it. Mm-hmm. And if you know how bad it was and the form of that treatment, the next time you see a human rights issue, a social issue on the streets of Regina, you might have a backstory that will give you a slightly, you know, hopefully a different response to what's going on now.
Great. Thank you so much for...
That's a great great note to finish up on here. We've got to the end of our time.
Thanks a lot, guys.
It's been wonderful having you here, Jim. And maybe we can do something similar again sometime soon.
Sure, that'd be great.
As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all peoples. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said it's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness.